Hey everybody, welcome to our third, and it's been so long since Tim and I have been able to do this, Star Wars podcast. This time we're going to focus solely on Rogue One because Tim and I have seen it and we are overly obsessed because we are huge Star Wars fans. Welcome,
Absolutely.
Tim. How
Hey, it
are
was
you doing
great to be
today?
back. It's been from a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away since The Force Awakened was out, huh?
Yeah, a year?
I know we're getting so spoiled here. All of a sudden, it's been so long since I got to see a new Star Wars movie. It's been, 12 months. And I like that kind of spoiling. If this is going to continue, I have no complaints.
I think I'm more than happy with getting a Star Wars movie every year for the rest of my life and a bunch of tie-in media in between the movies and all the collectibles and everything. So I'm fully embracing the oversaturation of Star Wars. And when it comes to Rogue One, I don't think you or I could be more happy with the end result. So why don't you tell me your. Okay, let me just first preface and say that if you haven't seen the movie, we're going to talk about everything, and it's probably going to turn into an incoherent mess. So, if you have seen the movie, I think you will enjoy this chat because we're going to be bouncing around talking about spoilers and
Yes.
how everyone dies.
Yep. Everyone dies. Rogue
Literally.
One. RIP. There. You have been totally spoiled if you haven't seen the movie yet. I want to, you know what I want to do? What I want to start with, because I've been thinking about this and thinking about this, because I want to address one of the main criticisms of this movie, and one of the reasons that I think it actually is a strength. There are a lot of people who are complaining about they call it thin characterization. Well, they got a bunch of people running around doing stuff, but you don't really get to know them all that well. Number one, I mean, that's bullshit as far as Jen goes. And I think it's bullshit as far as Cassian Andor goes, too. They give you just enough of him to really let you know who he is. But as far as everyone else goes, I think the amount of characterization we get is in keeping both with the time period in this galaxy, which sucks, and with it being a war movie where we're not getting the glamorous, we're not getting the chosen one Luke Skywalker, we're not getting the clearly new chosen one Rey. We are getting boots on the ground types who are never going to get glory. They're never going to get, they're not going to get their own huge spin-off movies where they get to go have romances and do all that stuff. They're foot soldiers in a nasty war, a nasty, complicated interplanetary war, and they don't really have a lot of time to sit around and swap stories and make a lot of jokes and stuff like that. They are trying to stop this thing before it starts. And the more I think about it, I hope I'm making sense, but the more I think about it, the more that really rings true to me that these in many ways are not hugely special characters. Of course, they're all special and they do great heroic things, but they do it at a very grimy, grunty base level. And that to me, the characterization, the amount of characterization in the film is really in keeping with that. And it's working for me the more I think about it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think that there needs to be as much development for this film. I'm not even really sure what that criticism is supposed to mean, other than the person doesn't like Star Wars and they're going to start nitpicking stuff, because
Right.
I think that this film is a double-edged sword because it is for Star Wars fans. I mean, there are so many Easter eggs throughout, both sets of trilogies to tie this movie all together, as well as this being a standalone movie, to where you probably really. I find it hard to believe you would find a viewer that really doesn't know much about Star Wars. I think it's been so ingrained in our pop culture
Right.
since the release of it that people know who Darth Vader is, people know what the Death Star is. But I think that this film will serve those people just as well. Maybe not just as well. I think this movie serves the hardcore fan base very well. But I think that this film, if you go into this, and this is essentially the first Star Wars movie you've seen in whole and not just bits and pieces on TV, I think you would enjoy this because there is a lot of things to enjoy about it. That being said, I was thinking a lot about this today, which I wrote a piece, which is on our website, which I'll plug. Why? What, I don't even remember what it's called. So it's going to be. Oh, this is what it's called. Good plug. Why Rogue One is the most important Star Wars film to date. Now, you and I, our initial reaction, I know my initial reaction was, I think this is the best Star Wars film. It's not, but it is, because of an array of different reasons. But when I really hone down on why I think this film is important and why I like it so much, let me preface by saying I think when the dust settles and the high of Rogue One wears off, this film is going to rank in or right behind the original trilogy. I think it'll be like, either it's going to, whatever the people's personal preferences are, for me, it's probably going to go Empire Strikes Back, Star Wars, Rogue One, Jedi. I think for a lot of people, it'll be the original trilogy, Rogue One, The Force Awakens, and then the prequels for the, you know, for those who don't like the prequels or whatever. But I think that this film is fundamentally important for a couple of different reasons. I think that this film is a bridge between the prequels and the original trilogy.
A good one, a strong one.
Yes, it is, because, and you're the perfect guy to talk to about this, because you don't like the prequels nearly as much as I do, which I get it. I appreciate that you're not a fucking George Lucas bagger, prequel hater.
No, no.
Like, I can't, yeah, those people just, I don't mesh well with them, obviously. But the inclusion of casting Jimmy Smits as Bail Organa and Genevieve O'Reilly as Mon Mothma, both of who played the respective parts in Revenge of the Sith, which is nearly 15 years old.
Wow.
You know, it's probably 12, it's 12 years old at this point. I think that is the perfect way to incorporate the prequels without riling up too many people. And I think people who don't like the prequels, who I've had discussions with about Rogue One, really appreciate the fact that they stuck with the casting of those two characters. Which, I mean, these two characters are incredibly important, not only in the lore of Star Wars, but even to the original trilogy. I mean, Mon Mothma shows up in Jedi for a while. Bail Organa's not in the original trilogy, but I mean, you know he's important because he's Leia's dad, and he gets blown up on Alderaan.
Yeah, that was sad to see him walk off when that moment where he's like, I'm going home, and you're like, oh, you don't know the half of it, Bail. You are going
like,
home.
Fuck, but maybe he's gonna live. But
no, he's not fated to that. But I agree completely, and it's you know, love him or hate him, absolutely the prequels are canon. They are written and directed by the creator of the entire universe. As we've discussed before, despite their faults, they probably include some of the best fight sequences of the entire series. And a lot of other moments that are a lot of fun too. So it is good, and it's the right way to do things, obviously, to not just recast and or just, you know, they could have figured out a way to not have Bail there. They could have figured out a way to not on Mothma there. But to go to the care of not only having them in there, but bringing those actors back from Sith, I think was great. And yeah, it provides a real continuity, and it helps provide continuity in a movie that is such you know, an interesting experiment. You know, there's no Roman numeral in front of this one. There's no real Jedi running around. There's just our favorite Sith Lord. And, you know, it's a lot of risks going on. So I think part of that not only is fan service, but I think that's just smart storytelling to help include it into the broader saga.
Oh yeah. I think, I mean, if you look at it from a movie-making thematic narrative standpoint, the sole purpose for Bail Organa, Mon Mothma, Darth Vader, and the CGI resurrection of Peter Cushing, which we're going to get to, the sole purpose for them to be in this film is to anchor it and say, hey, this is a Star Wars movie. We're not going to have Jedis. You're not going to see Luke. You're not going to see Wookiees. You know, there's no Ewoks, but this is a Star Wars movie, and it's okay because we have these handful of characters, you know, and the ships, of course. I also think how this is a bridge from the prequel trilogy, well, considering that this is technically, I would say, a prequel / standalone film, but how else this serves a great purpose as a bridge is because the aesthetic shifted hard from the prequels to the new trilogy. The old trilogy. Granted, it takes place months before the events of A New Hope, but this is the aesthetic that we are so used to seeing.
Yes.
This looks like the dilapidation of the rule of the Galactic Empire. It's not prosperity and peace within the galaxy, which is the bright and shininess of the prequel trilogy.
Yeah, no, the Jedi Temple is down.
Right.
I mean, it's in the dust. And what are they called? The Guardians of the Wills? The Guardians of the Wills don't even have a temple. You know, that's in the original title when Lucas was writing it back in the early 70s. The original title talked about the Wills. It was kind of like an ancient holy book that the Jedi faith was going to be based on. I don't know if you caught this or not, because when they are there and they're in town and, you know, they run into... Is it Chirrut? You know, the blind dude. Yes, and his friend. It's briefly mentioned that they are from the Order of the Wills, or the Guardians of the Wills. And I thought that was a great shout out, because that's never been used in any actual movie before. But for the heavy geeks, that particular term jumps out. So sorry to interrupt. That was just Easter eggs that I just love.
This brings me to my last point I wanted to make, that also coincides with the write-up that I did. I think I was kind of hasty with my write-up, and I left out a lot of points that I'm going to think about, but that's the beauty of the internet, because I will continue to mold Podcasting Them Softly into my Star Wars outlet.
There you go.
speaking of that, what you were just talking about, Forrest Whitaker's character Saw Gerrera, I think, is a very important tool that Disney decided to use. Now, the origin of this character was originally conceived by George Lucas for the unproduced Star Wars Underworld live-action show that was announced in 2005. I mean, after the prequel trilogy came out, they were going to do like 3 or 4 live-action shows. They were going to do all this shit, and then somehow the bottom fell out. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly what happened. I don't know if it was the fanboy wrath at George Lucas that just kind of killed everything.
All the quotes I ever read said it was budget issues. That I remember Lucas specifically saying, "We've got 60 or so screenplays. You know, we've got the scripts. We just haven't figured out how to make it economically viable." And there may have been much more to that. But anyway, go on back to Saw.
And then Saw shows up in season 5 of the animated show Clone Wars, which is on Netflix. And if anybody has an inkling to check it out, I implore you to. Clone Wars is very good. It turns the page really fast from being a kid-friendly show to a adult-oriented show in the first season. And it becomes clearer as the seasons progress that this is made for adult Star Wars fans. That being said, and it also really helps flesh out the prequels. I enjoy the prequels so much more because of the Clone Wars show. You actually get to see the Clone Wars in the Clone Wars show, which we'd never seen in the prequels because it takes place in that 2-year gap between Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith. Anyway, Saw shows up in a 4-episode arc in the 5th season of Clone Wars. And he's this gray-scaled bastard character that's a fringe, that's associated to the Republic, but in a fringe group that will stop at any, that won't stop to destroy the Separatist army. And he'll do whatever he needs to do to try and destroy the Separatists and keep them from his planet. I can't remember which planet he's on. Mm-hmm. But moral of the story is his character is not only inconsequential to the Clone Wars show, but inconsequential to the Star Wars, the overarching Star Wars universe in general. Now, Forrest Whitaker could have easily had an original organic name in Rogue One, and it would not have taken away from his character whatsoever. He could have had zero ties to anything that was existing already in Star Wars lore, and you would have accepted the character and who he is, partly because Forrest Whitaker got cast, and he brings authenticity and weight to the role.
Yes.
But I think this serves two major purposes that Disney wanted to do. They wanted to take a character that already existed in another medium that wasn't a cinematic medium, that wasn't from a film, and port it into the cinematic universe of Star Wars. This marks the first time they have ever taken a character from a cartoon, comic, or book and put them into a movie. So I think we're going to be seeing a lot more fan favorites like Ahsoka and Cad Bane and Grand Admiral Thrawn show up in these standalone non-saga films. Now, my other point is I think this is Disney paying respect and being very gracious to George Lucas, considering that Saw Gerrera is a George Lucas creation. And I don't know, and I don't want to read too much into it, and I don't want to start weird rumors, but there has to be some sort of love lost between Disney and George Lucas. I mean, the guy has zero to do with Star Wars now after he sold the entire franchise over to Disney. I mean, I'm like even a little shocked he's not even like a token producer in the credits.
I think he's executive producer, but we all know what that means at this point. And I agree, you know, he was there not necessarily doing the greatest job of helping promote The Force Awakens a year ago. Obviously came out and said some negative things about it and then retracted them, but was also involved in some of the lighter marketing moments. And we've really heard nothing from him about Rogue One, which was pretty surprising to me, but I think it does speak, you know, because Rogue One was not something that he had originally conceived. So, you know, you'd think maybe he wasn't as attached to it. He obviously had treatments for 7, 8, and 9 that Disney said thanks, but no thanks on.
Right.
Although I still think they've probably borrowed some fairly major plot slash family points from them. They're just doing a lot of different things with them. But yeah, I agree. It's nice of Disney to do that. I hope there's more of that. I hope that there is a mending of fences at some point so he can kick back and really enjoy it. But I understand it too. You know, this ended up being his life's work. It's clearly work that has touched probably billions of people at this point. And he sold it. Nobody stole it from him. It's not like there was some Stan Lee, Jack Kirby fight over rights or anything that went on for years. He got a good deal. I think he'll be eating three squares a day for the rest of his time on God's green earth. So I'm not really too worried about him from that standpoint. But it's still, you know, you get to that point of money flying around, and it's funny money at that point. You know, it's still his baby, and I'm sure it still smarts a little bit. But I hope he went in and saw this and said, "Wow, that was a really fun Star Wars war movie."
Gareth Edwards said like a week or two before the movie came out that George Lucas saw it and loved it, and Edwards said he could die a happy man, which I thought was really nice. And then of course, a lot of the snark kicked in.
It always does.
Because poor George Lucas, it's gotten to the point where poor George Lucas is being single-handedly blamed for Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, the fourth Indiana Jones movie that do you like that movie?
I'll tell you what, let's switch gears for just a second. I loved Lucas's concept for Kingdom of the Crystal Skull to move everything up from, you know, it was the Nazis and it was mystical stuff in the first three, and then to move it into the 50s where it's the Red Scare and it's alien paranoia. That's the kind of movies that were coming out at that time. I thought it was very period authentic to take this swashbuckler who we all know is, you know, coming up against supernatural forces and stuff anyway. We've seen plenty of it. And to have it be aliens, I was fine with that. And I really liked the introductory sequence. I thought it was actually one of the lovelier sequences, the credit sequence and then the chase scene, and yes, even the lead lined refrigerator. I loved it. It's indie, you know, this is Indiana Jones. This is fun stuff. I thought as soon as Shia came in and as soon as they got down to the jungle and everything turned to bad CGI, then it was pretty bad. But I didn't blame that wholly on Lucas. I knew that the basic concept for the film came from Lucas's brain. I actually would probably get a little more down on Spielberg and his job of directing, to be fair.
I mean, I don't want to digress too much.
Yeah.
And I don't mean to sound like a total asshole because I know what this feels like when people say it to me about the prequels, but I think The Crystal Skull is one of the worst movies ever made.
Fair enough. Many
and it's abomination to the franchise. Mm-hmm. But I mean, if you're going to lay blame, Lucas wasn't even a writer. Who was it? Cope?
Mm-hmm. Who's
writing the new one too?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But
no.
I mean, I think equal blame gets thrown on Harrison Ford, Steven Spielberg, Lucas, and Kep.
Well, and let's not forget Shia.
Yeah, but I think Shia's redeemed himself a little bit over the past couple of years with his more abstract roles he's taken. But anyway, we could do an Indiana Jones podcast, I suppose, at some point.
We'll hammer one of those out. But yes, back to Rogue One.
But back to Rogue One. All right, throw out another, what's something else that you just absolutely loved in this film?
Well, the big surprise to me, where I think it grabbed my heart, and probably a lot of others, you know, obviously everyone was looking forward to having Darth Vader come back. And about halfway through, we are introduced to the palace of Darth Vader, which is something that in production notes and in discussions for the original trilogy, they were going to have scenes at Darth Vader's palace, but they never could figure out a way to write it in, because he was always on a ship. So that is actually a cool piece of kind of unseen canon that we finally get to see right there too.
Yes.
And so I thought that was pretty cool. Although my understanding is officially it was on Mustafar.
Yes.
The planet where he got hacked up and left for dead, which I said that to you yesterday. I'm like, what kind of self-loathing does this guy have that he would put his palace right there in the middle of the lava where he almost died, and lost everything, you know? But anyway, that was a nice scene. It's all done very dramatically, you know, the lighting is just and smoke and all that. Then he comes out and he has his conversation with Krennic, which it does help to set up what the kind of the duplicity that's going to go on and why Krennic is not in A New Hope and why he, you know, loses that gig to Tarkin. So that's fine, but it wasn't anything great. And I was like, okay, well, if that's all we get for a Darth Vader cameo, that's nice, but it would have been nicer to. And then, you know, the last 5 minutes of the movie, they extend that chase sequence. You know, they basically reimagine the whole thing. They just do it on a different ship. And to have him come out and do that, I mean, you know, you feel bad. It's like when people were cheering for Hannibal Lecter when he says he's going to go have a friend for lunch at the end of Silence of the Lambs. Right. You know, you feel bad for cheering, but oh my God, you've been waiting to see that all your life. You didn't realize it until now. So that's obviously a high point for me. And as far as the final battle goes, I think it's built up to very nicely, but that final battle is one of my favorite Star Wars space battles, I think, of all the films. It may be my favorite. And that's saying something, because this is the franchise that invented space dogfighting. You know, there was nothing like it of any scale like what we saw before we saw Star Wars, before we saw them, you know, fight to escape the Death Star and then come back and destroy the Death Star. And then obviously there's one aspect of Empire that's just a big space chase. And then there's another Death Star fight, you know, on and on and on and on. You've seen a lot of spaceships whipping around, but the way they set it up and the way they bring it about, it so justifies, you know, that it's like the very first line, I think, in the crawl on episode 4, A New Hope, when they talk about how the rebels have just scored their first real victory against the Empire. And to see that in just beautifully shot, and my hat goes off to Edwards and his cinematographer, because I think that's one of the best looking Star Wars movies, if not the best looking Star Wars movie we've gotten. But to see all that in great scale and the way they manage the stakes through it, and obviously the sacrifices that are made, it's just marvelous. They did such a good job. Throwing those Star Destroyers together to crash out the gate was fantastic. Just watching the crew go down. At what point did you realize they were all fucked?
Okay. You may have to help steer me here, because I have like six different things going in my head that I want to get out.
Right.
You know what? I just want to address how I did love the planetary names. This is the first time in a Star Wars movie where we've been given location.
Yes,
names.
Very, very different, very new.
Which I liked, but they strategically left out Mustafar for Vader's castle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes, they
which
did.
I was like, that has to be Mustafar. It's a volcano planet. It's like, where else would Vader be than the place where Obi-Wan chopped him up and left him for dead?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I did find myself watching the movie waiting for Darth Vader to show up. I'm like, okay, I know Vader's in this, and he probably has to have as much, if not less, screen time than he does in A New Hope. And, you know, he's got the whole Lecter thing going for him in Silence of the Lambs. I think he's only in A New Hope for like 15 minutes.
Well, and you were saying, you make the great point, how many actual Darth Vader lightsaber fights have we gotten to see on
film?
Well,
here's the thing.
Barely
yeah.
any.
Right, and I'll get to that in a second. So, I think a lot of us were under the impression that everybody was going to die, But while we were so wrapped up in what we were seeing, I think any preconceived ideas or notions we had in our head just evaporated. And I can tell you my mind did not wander once while watching Rogue One, both times I've seen it, because you're just so enamored in this world that we've seen but we haven't seen yet. And it's an experience. It was a very surreal experience, I should say, mm-hmm. watching this movie, because it's not a saga film. It's not anchored by a Skywalker. You just don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. but you do. It's very difficult to describe other than the word surreal, I think, while viewing this movie. Because you know what happens, but you don't know how it happens. You don't know the execution.
Right.
But I think that the third act of this film is a brilliant bait and switch. Because the entire third act is when they're getting the plans, when they're going on a literal suicide mission. Each one of them gets taken down one by one, and as it's happening, you know it's going to happen. You know each one of them are going to die. You don't really know how, but it doesn't really matter. And then the Death Star shows up above the planet of Scarif, and you know exactly what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know that fucking Tarkin is going to pull the lever, and just everybody's going to die. Which I want to come back to Mendelsohn with that, mm-hmm. because I think that's just brilliant. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Jyn and Cassian embracing as the ripple of the Death Star beam or whatever's happening, as the ripple of the planet is exploding, mm-hmm. they just are engulfed and vaporized.
Mm-hmm. In a classically romantic scene.
Yes.
You know, the framing, the shot is just brilliant because it's these two young, beautiful people looking at the sunrise on the beach, you know. But
it's
really
like,
they're staring right. down their own death.
You know, it's like a mixture of From Here to Eternity
mm-hmm.
when they're making out on the beach, and then the end of Melancholia, the Von Trier
right.
movie, where it's just like this beautiful cataclysm of death.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think the audience is just gutted by the loss of all our heroes. And it's like, we still got, I don't know, you know, maybe 20 minutes left of the movie. So
yeah.
all our heroes are dead. All the main characters are dead. And, you know, the rebels have the plans. And they're going to hyperspace out of there, and they're going to get the fuck out and give it to whoever. And then Vader's Star Destroyer shows up, and, like, six ships blow up as they're trying to, like, hyperspace, and they hyperspace into the Star Destroyer. And it's just like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
This is where it gets real. And I can't even tell you, man, like, what I'm talking about with a brilliant bait and switch is all our heroes are dead. We really don't have much more. We don't have an emotional investment anymore, theoretically, because we have no one to root for. We don't have anybody to watch because everybody's dead. And I'll tell you what, I might have been like this for you. I can't imagine for those of us who saw it on opening day, opening weekend, whatever. When the Death Star plans are being passed between rebel troopers through, like, doors that are,
yeah.
like, slamming
oh, yeah.
shut, and it's just, like, this sense of immediate urgency that we need to get this little fucking card to whoever we're going to give it to, and you get that, like, 45-second Darth Vader rage, and where he just fucking kills everybody in the most brutal way possible, and mm-hmm. that is something, as a Star Wars fan, that we have never ever seen before.
Nope.
And the entire audience was fucking cheering at the screen.
Yeah.
Because this was something that everybody's waited, you know, a lot of people have waited their whole life to see the fucking Vader rage, man.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And
yep.
I mean, what's the only other thing is, like, when Anakin and Obi-Wan are fighting, because technically he's Darth Vader, but, like, no.
No,
you wanna
he's not
see
Darth Vader
the fucking,
yet.
Yeah, you want to
yeah.
see the 8-foot fucking suit.
Yeah.
You want to see the fucking Man in Black kill everybody with his red lightsaber.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that was just a brilliant move on their part,
mm-hmm.
on Edward's part, Disney's part, whoever's part, to get the audience fucking jacked. in the final moments of the film.
Yeah, I foolishly did not know if we'd be seeing him again or not, but I was waiting. I figured the hopeful note they were going to end on was going to be Leia, and of course they did, you know, with the word hope coming out of her mouth and everything. So they do, you know, and the nice thing, I think one of the reasons that they got away with what they did by killing off Rogue One is no more. They're not coming back. They're not going to fight the next battle. The reason that they could get away with that is because you've seen the next movie. And they, you know, that's a very conscious thing that, you know, they get to go. I think they earned the ability, or they had the ability, to go darker because you know that the next chapter is A New Hope and that there is hope. They talk a lot about hope, obviously, in the third act, as they're trying to hold on to hope as things get more and more desperate. But, you know, what a great weighty sacrifice to see the rebellion have to make in order to have the great success that Luke Skywalker and the rest of the gang goes on to have in the next one. I think it flows together really nicely. Let me ask you, tell me about some of your favorite characters. Who are some of your favorites? What did you like about them? What didn't you like about them?
I mean, obviously Ben Mendelsohn for me, I think, was probably my favorite character because I don't think we've seen such an imperial bastard before. And I mean, he's just fucking mean and he's evil. You know, what's our introduction to him is when he tells his squadron of death troopers, which were so much cooler than I thought they were going to be.
They were great.
Kill Mads Mikkelsen's wife.
Right.
And I mean, obviously I'm getting the book for Christmas, the prequel book to Rogue One. Mm-hmm. Catalyst, that's basically about the relationship between Mendelsohn and Mikkelsen.
Gotcha.
Which should be a very cool read. But I mean, these are people that have known each other for a very long time. Granted, they're not on the best of terms now because it seems like Mads Mikkelsen is in exile and doesn't want to be found.
And then,
you know, Mendelsohn finds him and just instantly kills his wife, has his death troopers kill his wife.
Yeah.
And I mean, holy shit. And so you have that aspect of him just being this terrible person. And then you have the conflict between him and Tarkin, which I think is just great. They're adversaries within the Empire. And, you know, I shouldn't say they're necessarily competing with each other, but Mendelsohn seems to be competing for the Emperor and Vader's attention.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, those guys are running neck and neck to run the show, to be the top lieutenants, you know,
right,
obviously.
To be the guy in control of the Death Star. That's what the two of them are essentially have a conflict over. And it's fantastic when, you know, they blow up Forrest Whitaker on his little hideout. And Tarkin's just like, yeah, did a good job. Okay, it's mine now.
Yeah, I was wrong about you. Your machine does work. I will be glad to take it over now.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think the beautiful irony of everything is I was convinced that Mendelsohn was going to be force choked and killed by Vader in the movie.
Uh-huh.
Because you can't have that character live because he's not in the original trilogy. You know what I mean? You're right. It's like this movie was just a loop because you could do whatever you want with the characters essentially because you don't have to keep them. There's not going to be a sequel. They're not in any of the original movies. But I was blown away, literally, or I should say, no pun intended, by how Mendelsohn gets killed. Tarkin, you know, hyperdrives the Death Star into the planet, and Mendelsohn is looking up at the Death Star as the beam comes down and like pretty much hits him in the face. Like the beam comes down on the tower where Mendelsohn is looking up at it. It's awesome. It's like he gets killed by his own weapon by Tarkin.
Right. And with, obviously, you had to have our heroes get one last shot in on him, too. You know, of course, it was kind of inevitable. We'd have up at the top of the dangerous tower some gunplay and whatnot. And that was nice, obviously, to have Cassian and Jin get a little a little taste of revenge on him, especially Jin. Obviously, I was actually surprised Jin was not given more of a revenge moment because, as you noted, Krennic killed his mom, or her mom, and took her father away for all of her important formative years, and she literally was left in a hole to survive, by hook or by crook. So I was a little surprised. It worked fine for me. It wasn't that it didn't work. And I think the larger narrative of this guy who is so focused on creating this thing of destruction, which of course in turn destroys him, is a fine arc as well. But I think with Jin, that's also kind of part of the story of all of these heroes, isn't it? That while they are our protagonists and we are rooting for them and we know that they're the good guys, I think they do a pretty good job of showing that all of them are flawed in one way or another. We've got a repurposed Empire robot in K2SO. We have Cassian Andor, who's introduced as a captain, but we soon come to find out, no, he's not a captain. He's a hitman. He's an assassin. He kills for the rebellion, and that means he's probably been in a lot of compromised positions before. And then the pilot who brings the message that has the key to the Death Star's downfall, Bodhi Rook, played by Riz Ahmed, he is on a redemptive journey as well because he's an ex-Empire pilot. He has been piloting stormtroopers around the galaxy to probably go kill innocent men, women, children, aliens, what have you. And then there's Mads Mikkelsen. There's obviously Galen, who has designed this thing, tried to run away from it, and just be a good family man. But just like it's like in the old westerns, you don't just get to run off to the
There's
prairie,
no clean
and
getaways,
there's no clean getaways that always comes
right?
back to find you. So the fact that it wasn't just a clear cut, oh, and Jin happens to find the one existing lightsaber and cut Krennic in half and everyone cheers, that feels kind of appropriate because there aren't really happy endings for the heroes of this movie. There are dutiful and purposeful endings.
Right. And I like the fact that Jin doesn't kill Krennic. I like that she has a sense of purpose and urgency for the first time in her life. She needs to get these plans to the fleet above the planet so they can get the plans to Leia, who gets the plans to, her dad, who gets blown up. But you know what I mean? She has a purpose and a duty, and that's what I think is very cool about her character build. Because, I mean, when we first see her, she's a drifter, she's a punk, she just does whatever she wants to do. She knows how to fight people and be an insurgent because she was pretty much raised by Forrest Whitaker's character. But I like that, and I like the simple twist of fate of Krennic being killed by what he wants the most. The power that he wants the most. All right, how many times have you seen it? Have you just seen it once so far?
I have seen it the one time, with the holidays and everything, we're busy
Right,
over here,
right,
but I'm
right.
going to try and get out and see it again soon because I suspect I'll probably figure out a lot more fun nuggets about it. Just to back up real quick, too, Saw Gerrera is another character that fits right into everything we're saying here, who is a guy, like you said, going back to the Clone Wars cartoons, who was a noble warrior who then became a intransigent kind of idealistic warrior who then got so kind of down his own rabbit hole about how this should work and got so torn apart by it. We see him in clearly a physically diminished state. He's like this sad sack alternative to Darth Vader, with his crappy cape and his one robot foot, and he's sucking on his Frank Booth mask every once in a while to just
Right.
walking around. It's been taken out of him too. That's just the kind of wounding of all of these characters throughout, how they're wounded, how they've wounded themselves, how they're trying to heal themselves. That's good
Right.
writing
He,
going
he's
on
he's
there.
become Colonel Kurtz.
He's the Colonel Kurtz of the movie.
Right. I was gonna. Now, what I asked you if you've seen it twice is because I've seen it twice, and the two things that I looked for the most were if my opinion changed on the CGI recreation of Peter Cushing, but more specifically Leia. Or I should say a young Carrie Fisher as Leia for the final moment of the film. I thought Tarkin looked amazing. You could still slightly tell that he was a CGI recreation, some rendering. I mean, there was, you just.
Comes down to the eyes for me. It's they still don't quite have the eyes down. But yes, I thought they did a good job. And I don't mind it that much in this context. It's
I
Star
love it.
Wars.
I think it's
In
great.
this particular context, it's Star Wars. You can certainly argue the franchise was one of the most groundbreaking special effects franchises and continues to be. And the fact that they would take technology, I mean, we've seen it here and there a little bit in Tron Legacy and Captain America Civil War. You get a young Robert Downey Jr. and some things like that. So,
Westworld, I
it's
think, is the most
coming.
recent one.
Westworld, yep, absolutely. And they've done fine work there too. So the technology is coming along, and I think it was pretty good. I've seen a lot of people who didn't like Leia. I thought Leia looked great. I thought she actually looked very warm and human, even with a little bit of the rendering, like you said, that's going to be apparent still. And also the fact that she's got one shot. You see her basically
You
once,
see
and
her
that
for
closes the
15
movie.
seconds.
And I think that's kind of perfect in using the technology. I think with Tarkin, it maybe started to pull me out of it a little bit more, just because he actually has a fair amount of scenes. I did not know, kind of like with Vader, I didn't know if he was just going to come in and be a one or two off thing. He actually
Right.
comes pretty integral to the plot, though. I mean, and
He's.
they needed to do that to explain why he's in charge when you get to A New Hope.
I mean, essentially, he's the antagonist of the film, I think. I think he's the big bad of the movie in a way. I think that I don't know. I guess I'm talking myself out of it now that I'm actually,
I don't know if
audibly
I'd quite call him
articulating
the
it.
big bad. I mean, it's so tough to say that in a movie that, has Darth Vader in it. But
But
Darth Vader is not the big bad of the movie. He
right.
is a fun, that's pure fan service candy right there, obviously.
But when they first started casting this movie and they announced that they cast Ben Mendelsohn as the villain, my initial thought was he's going to be Tarkin. I
Yeah,
think
I
he
thought so too.
I think he would have been perfect as Tarkin. He resembles Cushing enough ish.
You put him in the outfit.
You put him in the outfit and he can play smarmy like Cushing played Tarkin in A New Hope, but when it came out that he was Krennic, like some newfound character, was like, okay, well, Tarkin has to be in this movie. Like, and they kind of messed around a little bit with it in Revenge of the Sith, where we see Tarkin and the last scene, second to last scene of Revenge of the Sith, where they got another actor and kind of did a little CGI work on his face. And of course, it's not a close up, it's, a long shot of Tarkin the Emperor and Vader watching the Death Star being built, and Tarkin walks away. But I it broke somewhere, maybe about a year ago. It might not have been that long ago, maybe 6 months ago, that they were going to CGI recreate Tarkin. And I thought to myself, well, shit, that's really cool. I wasn't expecting so much. I mean, there's more Tarkin in this than there is in A New Hope.
Practically, yeah. At least as many scenes, if not more.
I think he
Absolutely.
has two scenes in A New Hope. When they blow up Alderaan, I think that's the last time you see Tarkin is when they blow up Alderaan at the beginning of the movie, I want to say,
Well,
unless I'm
like
forgetting.
you, I'm pretty sure on Friday you did exactly what I did, which is you watched Rogue
Fuck.
One and
Yeah, I
then you went
did.
home and watched the sequel called A New Hope.
Right.
So I popped that in. And there's a fair amount of dialogue scenes with Tarkin in the early to middle going, but he does pretty much disappear in
Yeah,
the
he just he
first
dis which is
act.
fine. But see, when you first see Tarkin, you see his reflection in the window of the Star Destroyer while they're watching, the big satellite weapon being put into the Death Star. And I'm like, okay, are they just going to kind of hide him? And he's only going to speak from, when Mendelsohn's behind him and he's not facing him. I wasn't prepared for the full on, medium shot of Mendelsohn and Peter Cushing walking together and having verbal exchanges, and how animated Mendelsohn was getting with his frustration of dealing with Tarkin. I was so impressed with it, and I was even more impressed and sold on it with my second viewing, because I suppose I was more comfortable with it. It wasn't as much of a shock to me the second time I saw it, because I knew I was going to get, the full-on Tarkin. Now, I can't wait. I read that Industrial Light and Magic is going to get into more of an explanation next month on how they did Tarkin because I think they want more people to see the movie, and they essentially don't want to create spoilers the opening weekend or opening week or month or whatever of the movie.
Right.
Now, from what I've been reading, what they did was Peter Cushing's secretary, is the executor to his estate, because Cushing, I guess, didn't have any kids and there was no one to give his estate to, so his secretary got it. ILM went to his secretary, said, "Hey, we have this idea. We want to CGI recreate him. We have footage from the original movie that we kind of want to model it after that was unused. Can we do this?" She said, "Sure." I know that they had a stand-in. It was some BBC actor. I was reading about it. Washington Post had a really good article. But I don't know what they did for his voice.
I'm guessing that probably a mixture of just finding the right voice actor and combining that in with some digital trickery. The voice to me, just knowing, I'm no expert, but just knowing what levels sound engineering is at in this day and age, I think it's a lot easier to play with that than it's a bigger challenge to stick the visual landing than it is the audio landing, if that makes sense.
Right.
So I don't know either. Obviously, there is new dialogue written that Peter Cushing didn't just happen to
Right.
throw together back in the day in case he got a prequel, because I'm sure they didn't have many of those kinds of discussions back then. But they did a good job with that, and again, I thought they did a good job with Princess Leia, and I think she didn't need to be in the movie one more second than she did. But I think Tarkin, the way the story broke out, did need to be in the movie more than that to just kind of explain the power structure and how that went down. And the Sith and the Empire through the whole damn thing is always based on treachery. It's there's always, betraying your master or getting over on your subordinate before they get over on you. And I thought that the whole thing you're talking about with Tarkin and Krennic is very much in line with the way the bad guys work in the Star Wars universe. And bad guys work in general, which is they base everything on treachery. I want to ask you something, because you got to do something at your convention this summer that I did not get to do, which is meet General Organa herself. I want you to talk about that experience for a minute, because I've been dying to hear about it.
That was one of the greatest moments of my life. It was actually a really funny story. I was with a couple buddies. You can only have two people in a photo op, and there was three of us. And my buddy and I split I think it was like $100, and then it was like $20 for a printout, and then it was like $10 for a fucking sleeve, like a hard shell sleeve to put the photograph in, which of course I'm gonna buy. I'm not gonna fucking walk around with a printed out photo and like
They
nothing to protect it
know
with.
exactly how to gouge you
Right,
at those. Yeah, we've
right.
been going to them for
So the
years.
line was pretty long, and they were actually shuttling people in really fast. And we snuck my third buddy in, and she's just sitting there in her chair, like with her handlers. And Gary Fisher, her dog, is sitting on the chair next to her. And she's just like, "Oh, there's three of you?" And then, I kneel next to her. My buddy's behind me, and my other buddy's on the other side of her. And she's touching my one buddy's fucking face, and she's tugging on the back of my hair. And then it was just over. I don't, it was like, I don't remember anything of it. It was like a 20-second experience. I just remember seeing her and just being like, "Oh my God." And then it was just over.
It
And
was in and out. Yeah. Oh, that's still so cool though.
oh, it was,
There
it
are
was, it was. I fucked up like 2 years ago. The worst mistake of my life was when I didn't go to the Madison Comic Con in Wisconsin to meet Lando, Billy D. Williams with my buddy. Because I tried to get back with my ex-girlfriend and it just turned into a catastrophe, so I skipped
Well,
out on it.
priorities, Frank. Come
I
on.
know. Now I will never ever make a mistake like that again. It was probably the most valuable life lesson I have ever learned in my life. Don't ever skip a Comic-Con that has Billy D. Williams in it.
Well, maybe
So
he'll be back. We're still hoping he's going to be in episode
he's got to
eight
be in
anyway,
Episode
so
8. I mean, they
yeah.
recast him in the Han Solo movie. Okay, now let me ask you this. I might be making too much of a deal about it, and I don't want to sound like an asshole, like some Hollywood Reporter clickbait headline. But do you think that the CGI recreation of Leia causes some sort of conundrum since they just recast Han Solo and Lando for the Han Solo spin-off movie?
No, not at all. I they made a conscious decision. You know, they could have recast both roles. I think that would have been equally as distracting. I think when you're talking, so if they were going to do a whole Princess Leia movie, that's a different story. When you're talking about a cameo, you know, we're going to get to see these kids run around and play Han and Chewie and Lando as young, energized men. And if they tried to CGI Harrison's face and, you know, everybody else's face on for 2 hours, it wouldn't work. It's not the kind of thing that the
Right.
technology 10 years from now, Katie bar the door, they'll probably be doing
Ten
it for all the
years
fucking
from now,
time.
get James Cameron to make a Star Wars movie with de-aging actors.
Well, he's still going to be working on the Avatar sequels 10 years
No
from now.
shit.
Well, I think he's pretty well booked up until the end of time. But yeah, I mean, the technology is headed in that direction, and this is one of those major milestone movies where you can see it, but boy, there are times when you really can't, and you're like, once they get this down, I think about the fact that when Pixar started, they said their worst challenge, the thing they hated to do, was water. Water was so difficult for them. And if you look at CGI water now, I mean, they've now done two undersea movies and a whole host of others with water all over the place crashing around and looking gorgeous. I mean, the artists and computers will get us there. But it's not there now. So no, I don't think there's any kind of controversy over recasting for a young Han and recasting a young Lando. And I can't wait to see Donald Glover play Lando, quite frankly. I think he's pretty brilliant. So
I
I'm
was a
looking
bit
forward to that.
disappointed they didn't get Michael B. Jordan.
Yeah, he would have been a good fit too. Absolutely.
I
I
think
think he
Michael
would
B.
have been a good
Jordan
fit.
might have fucked himself a little bit with the Fantastic Four movie because he could have easily been Black Panther, Lando. He's going to be in the Black Panther movie anyway,
Well, that's
I
good.
think, because the guy who did Fruitvale Station and Creed's directing it, so they're like BFF. But I don't think I've seen Donald Glover in anything other than an episode or a half of episode of Community that I've seen.
Well, I would plug in I would give a plug for his show that just wrapped up on FX called Atlanta, which is a brilliant, funny, and sometimes really wrenching comedy that he did. And Community. I mean, Community, there's a lot of good Star Wars geekdom going on throughout Community.
Okay.
So that's a very geek-friendly show. He also has a new album out, which sounds like a lost Stevie Wonder album from about 77. So
Jesus.
called Childish
So
Gambino.
he's a pretty talented dude, is what you're
Super
saying.
talented guy. When I heard he was going to be in this, I was like, that is great because he'll kill it. He'll whatever they plan on doing with him, they'll kill it. So I'm looking forward to that. I don't know much about the other kid. I think I've seen him in one or two things who's going to be playing Han, but
He's in Hail Caesar, which I still haven't seen, and then he's in Warren Beatty's new movie.
okay, so pretty new to the scene, and he looks the part. You know, you see him in his red carpet photos online and whatnot, and he certainly looks the part. And Miller and Lord are a great pair of filmmakers, and I think they understand comedy so well. And you know, Han has always been one of the funniest things in the Star Wars universe, so I thought that was a really neat.
Well, let's not forget the most important part that Lawrence Kasdan is writing the screenplay for the Han
Yes.
Solo movie.
This is his swan song in the Star Wars
Yeah,
universe,
that's what he
isn't it?
said. He's
That's what
not
I
coming
hope.
back from Episode 8, apparently, and I had heard they're going to make the Han Solo movie into a trilogy, but I don't know if I don't know if pre A New Hope Han Solo has that much cinematic longevity.
If they
I
could
mean.
figure out a way to really have it be that he's had a long-standing back and forth with Boba Fett or something like that, then that could be fun. I mean, I think all of us fans are what we'd really like to hear is it's announced that Joe Johnson is going to direct a Lawrence Kasdan scripted Boba Fett movie, but I don't think that's
That's
going to happen.
apparently what the third, that's apparently what that third standalone movie is supposed to be that comes out after Episode 9. The
Are they going
one
to
that
grab Johnson though?
I have no idea. That's what
Okay.
Josh Trank got fired off of after
That was the
Fantastic
Trank one.
Four.
Yeah.
They haven't announced officially what it is. Personally, I'm excited for the Han Solo movie. I think we're gonna get the Kessel Run, we're gonna get the Life Debt with Chewie, we're gonna get Lando having the Millennium Falcon. We're going to get the debt with Jabba and probably some Boba Fett, but what I want most is I want an Obi-Wan movie.
And we have talked about this before, and we are both on the same page. And finally, McGregor came out and said this year that he's game for it. Why they are not in deep talks with his agent right now, I have no idea.
The big rumor now is they're not going to make an Obi-Wan movie till after Episode 9's over, alluding to the fact that, like, Obi-Wan's storyline really isn't done yet within the saga film. I don't know exactly what that means, but I was shocked we didn't see... Although we did get his voice, I thought for sure we were going to see Ewan McGregor in Episode 7 talking to Luke, but since we didn't see Luke until the last 2 minutes of the movie, I imagine we're going to get a spirit Ewan McGregor in Episode 8.
And I hope they figure out a way, and I kind of have trust in Rian Johnson on this front, because, you know, fanboys would immediately say, why isn't he old? Why are we seeing the, you know, middle-aged Obi-Wan? If they can figure out a way to just play that off with a good one-liner and just fucking walk away from it and keep telling the story of the movie, I hope they can do that, because Johnson does that in Looper. You've probably seen Looper, that's a time travel movie. And when, you know, old Bruce Willis runs into young Joseph Gordon-Levitt and they're the same people and they're sitting at a table in a diner, and one of them doesn't know what the hell's going on, the other one kind of does, and so one asks the other what the hell's going on, and he's like, I could sit here and make diagrams with straws and salt shakers for you all day, but just, it's time travel, okay? And then they move on, and it's just, that was so perfect. Like, don't get bogged down. Just have fun with it.
Yeah, I'm very excited now for the Han Solo movie, seeing what Rogue One is. I honestly felt that Disney had almost everything riding on the reception to Rogue One. Because the saga films are easier. You got Harrison Ford, Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill back. You know, going forward, you're gonna you had Ackbar. You had Nine Nub. You had all these characters. Going forward, it's going to be the Luke and Rey show in the next film, I imagine.
Yep.
And unless they kill Luke off in 8, which I think they're probably going to save that for 9. If Luke does get killed, I don't know. I'm sure you and I will have many a podcast that happened before that, hopefully. But yeah. But this was like the first non-Star Wars movie they did. We didn't talk about it, but quickly they handled the opening fucking amazing, I thought. A long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Cut to the opening scene. Cut to Rogue One in different letters with no theme. Cut to movie.
Well, they did have a theme on there.
I meant that it wasn't the Star Wars theme.
Yes, it was a different theme. I have to say, I thought Giacchino did a great job, and maybe I'll like it more the next time I see it, but that particular cue that they came up with for the title card, which, you know, it was just kind of like an off-chord, discordant version of what we were expecting or something. And it felt to me like it fell on its face a little bit. I hate to say it, but it's true. But I am more than willing to give it another chance. He is one of my favorite composers in Hollywood working right now. And, you know, I think he and Zimmer are probably the kind of top of the game, classic old school Hollywood big time movie scorers. And Williams, of course, he's still working. But I liked everything else he did. You know, he got to obviously use some of the themes we know, and he got to play with them. And I felt like he, especially watching A New Hope again, everybody knows the big themes. Everybody knows, dun, 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 you know, everybody knows that stuff. But if you actually pull out your Star Wars vinyl and put it on, as I do from time to time, and listen to the original score, there's so much incidental music going on that's very lively and very complicated, and it's not based on these kind of broad sweeping Johann Strauss style scores that everyone thinks of when they think of Star Wars. And Giacchino nailed it on that stuff. The incidental music that's going throughout Rogue One sounds totally Star Wars, but it is not just Star Wars stuff you've heard before. So I thought he did a really good job. And I thought some of the original stronger themes that he did were good too. So I don't want to take that away from him.
Yeah, I thought it was great. I've listened to the score a couple times on Spotify. I haven't bought the CD because, of course, I'm waiting for the vinyl that is imminent. And I'm sure you might be able to pick me up a picture disc at next record store day.
Since
I have the picture discs, the four vinyls for Episode 7, and I have all the original vinyls for the... for the original trilogy. The
last
thing
do you have the hologram one? I gotta ask. Did you get the hologram
one? No, I didn't. There's only so much money I can throw at that Star Wars machine before like I have to choose which bill I'm gonna pay at the end of the month. What I wanted to do, you think at any time they approached John Williams and said, "Would you be interested in scoring Rogue One?"
I kind of doubt it. I mean, my guess is.
Do you think they threw him like a token invite where it's like, if you're interested, we would love you to have it.
If you have any interest whatsoever, you can totally have it. But boy, we'd love to have you do Episode 8. And we don't, you know, how old is he? About 75 now. And I'm sure he's probably a pretty spry 75. He's had a good run. But there's probably only so much. So I think you nailed it. I'll bet they probably left the door wide open if he would like to walk through and take that assignment too. And if not, please help us out with Episode 8, and we will find one of your proteges, you know, if not direct protege, a spiritual protege, and a guy like Giacchino. That would be my guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure, for sure.
Well, I think that about wraps it up.
One more thing.
We didn't get to talk about reshoots, unless that's what you're going to bring up.
Well, we could... Okay, two things.
Okay.
First thing... is reshoots. If it doesn't make you too sick to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it framing it like clearly it's a better movie or a worse movie.
I don't have much to say on the reshoots. I think that a movie this good is not saved by last minute reshoots.
Yeah.
I think too much is being made out of the scenes we've saw in the trailer aren't in the movie. I was a little disappointed we didn't get to see Mendelsohn walking on water.
Yeah.
I thought that was the coolest. That was the coolest. Second to the AT-AT getting its head knocked by the rocket.
That's the best.
Which is incredible. But I think that I'm under the impression that Disney was so happy with the way Rogue One turned out, they wanted to throw a whole bunch of money at it. Mm-hmm. And make it better. I don't know how Gilroy got involved. I know Gilroy and Edwards are really good friends. And
yeah, they've worked together.
Gilroy came in on Godzilla. I know Disney paid fucking Gilroy like $10 million or something. Hollywood Reporter or Variety wrote an article about it about a month ago. And he got paid more than most top-tier directors get paid making movies. So Disney was extremely happy with whatever he did.
Mm-hmm.
So I think way too much is being made about reshoots, and it's turned into its own echo chamber on Facebook, because all day long we're seeing sponsored posts of these 15 scenes weren't in the film. Does this have something to do with the reshoots? It's like, dude, who gives a shit?
The only thing that I think you can, and I've looked over some of those shot-by-shot breakdowns, and not the real negative ones or anything either, but just ones where people have grabbed a bunch of stills from the marketing material. And it does bear repeating because it's pretty unprecedented in my experience that most of the things that we saw in the trailer were not in the movie. That's pretty amazing to me. And it's amazing, but it speaks to the fact that they had good stuff there too, because what we do get feels similar enough that if you're not really thinking about it, like, you know, we're overthinking things, then it's not going to really, you know, distract you. But the one thing that's interesting to me is you could tell that they must have clearly reworked a pretty significant portion of how the beach battle went down, because the original trailer includes a lot of shots of Jyn, Cassian, and K2SO running in different on the beach and through the facility with the Death Star plans clearly in her hand. So they reworked it. That's fine. They do that stuff all the time on movies, and they reworked it, as we discussed earlier in the podcast, quite nicely to very good effect. So there's no big deal there, but I think it's just worth pointing out for some of the people who might be listening who maybe didn't go to the trouble. That's the big takeaway for me, is that they reworked a fair amount of the final battle on the ground. But I'll bet at the end of the day, it was either going to get up on one last shuttle to the ship, or it was going to be beamed up. You know, I don't think it's like, oh, wait a minute, let's reshoot this where the whole team dies. It wasn't like they did anything like that at the 11th hour. And then the last thing, the other thing I wanted to ask, because we didn't talk about it at all, I thought they killed it on this, and, you know, it's Star Wars. We got to talk about the droids. So we have K2SO. How do you rank him amongst now the big four? We can call him the big four.
Now I'm thinking about a whole bunch of other shit, so I just want to interject and say how fucking amazing the Hammerhead Corvette was that pushed the Star Destroyer
into
the Star Destroyer that blew the gate up. I'm out of Legos at this point in my life, but if they do a Hammerhead Corvette, I'm going to be hard-pressed not to fucking buy the Lego Hammerhead Corvette.
You probably need to.
I need it, dude. Or like a nice model of it. I need something. Mm-hmm. I need a Hammerhead Corvette in my place.
My guess is Disney Corporation will be your friend on this one. So
that
just
was originally in Rebels too, by the way.
That's the Rebel ship, isn't it?
The Rebel ship's running around in there. The ship in Rebels, Ghost, is actually in the movie like three or four times.
It's in the space battle.
It's at Yavin. It's a nice little tie-in to the show. Mm-hmm. But the droid. Okay. I was very impressed by him because he was an emulation of C-3PO like BB-8 was an emulation of R2-D2.
Yes.
Now, I think BB-8 had a much harder job because R2-D2 is one of, if not the most beloved Star Wars character for a lot of people. I mean, there are fucking people who love R2-D2. And I mean, for me, BB-8 was my favorite, one of my, might even been my favorite thing about The Force Awakens. He's just fucking incredible.
Yep.
But, God, Alan Tudyk did a fucking great job, man.
He did. He did.
I was so impressed with the new droid. I thought he was really funny. I thought he had his own personality. Mm-hmm. He wasn't really a whiny bitch like C-3PO is.
He's kind of depressed. It was kind of hilariously depressed. He reminded me, I wonder if they took inspiration from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, because, you know, they've got that android in there that's always, he's smart, but he's just super mopey about everything. And they didn't really stick the landing on him in the movie as well as he is in the book. But he kind of reminded me of that. And I always thought, you know, R2... all the droids have been good for comedy relief. And that is something that has continued into here. Well, I mean, K2SO gets most of the good laugh lines. But BB-8 was just adorable. I mean, BB-8 covered the cute end of the Android spectrum.
He covered, like, the marketing end, the retail end, like, everything. You're right. I think that the new droid had a much harder job.
Yeah. And they did a great job of balancing him between the familiar and the unfamiliar. And they also did, you know, there's everybody gets along with R2, but like nobody likes C-3PO. It's like you can be a cute short droid in Star Wars, but if you're shaped like a human, then fuck you. That's kind of always been everybody, you know, I don't care how helpful you're being. And by the way, you're always being quite helpful, but fuck you. Get out of my way.
Right.
So, I mean, except when C-3PO is cock blocking Han, that's not very helpful, but
that
but he's
is
so
probably
good
one
at
of the,
it.
That's one know. Of the best moments in The Force Awakens.
It is.
When they see each other for the first time and C-3PO pops in and it's
right
just like
there.
That look Harrison Ford gives them is just classic.
And there is a good understanding of that here with the with Jyn and K2SO, who don't know each other, don't like each other, don't trust each other until the very end. And it's fun to see their relationship grow, where by the end, you know, they've got each other's backs, even though it's they're not going to send each other Christmas cards or anything. But I like that. I love it when one of those droids comes around, she just nails him. And then K2SO is behind it. It's like, did you know that wasn't me? They have a ton of good moments like that throughout. So I thought
even his death was pretty emotionally impactful.
Absolutely. Oh, that was terrible.
That was one of the worst deaths I felt.
Yeah, yeah.
That we see on screen. And a quick thing that we forgot to mention that I just recently read was that Donnie Yen, who plays the character's name I can't pronounce.
We'll just cheer it.
Chirrut, he brought to the role that the idea of him being blind.
Did he?
Which I think makes that character what it is.
It totally makes that character. Number one, I'm a huge Daredevil fan. So blind superhero, I'm totally in. And number two, you know what I noticed when I went home and watched A New Hope again, which was just perfect. The first time the Force ever starts to click for Luke, what's he doing? He's got a blaster helmet. He's blind. He's on the Falcon. They're doing that. Ben puts the helmet on him, and he can't see anything. And all of a sudden, he starts to block some shots from that little thing with the lightsaber. That's like the first time he's ever started.
I didn't even think about that.
Before. I wouldn't have thought about it until that happened. And obviously, I love Chirrut's character. He and his buddy, who's just got great. There's great Star Wars gun
Oh, his
going
whatever
on
gun thing he has is amazing.
It's sometimes it just is like a one-shot shotgun, then other times it's like he cocks it once and it's got 40 shots to just rip a bunch of guys a new one, and whatever it is, it was great. And yeah, so that stood out to me, and that's cool that he brought that to the table. I thought maybe that was even a reference to A New Hope, just because that's, you know, again, the first time Luke starts to feel the Force. It's when he closes his eyes.
I feel like if that character could see, it would diminish the powerfulness of him. It's the fact that he's a blind man that's a Jedi non-Jedi, essentially. You know
exactly.
I mean?
He's
I'm so glad he didn't bust out a lightsaber from his cane or some shit. Because I was reading a lot of people were saying that, like, they were hoping for, like, his final last stand. He was his cane was going to have a lightsaber in it because they tease it with Jyn's crystal.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, no, you can't have a lightsaber in this movie except for Vader.
Yeah, that's right, and we should point out to those who don't know that crystal hanging around her neck is exactly the kind of thing you stick in a lightsaber to make
right.
it go. So, yeah, that was pretty cool, too. Maybe we can close with this. I thought that it struck me how devoid of the Force, of the light side of the Force, the movie was. It was kind of like where we were at the beginning of A New Hope and where we were at the beginning of The Force Awakens, where it just hasn't been that strong for a long time. It got its ass kicked, and it's just hovering around the peripheries. And there's Force-sensitive people who can use it to some extent, but not to a great extent. And I loved how the Force was kind of an undercover agent in the movie. It's there, and it's talked about, but you never hear, "May the Force be with you." You hear new variations of it because they're not quite there, you know. And I liked how the Force was a non-present presence, whereas it's usually quite present in the other films. So I thought that was pretty cool.
You're right. I didn't think about that. The Force is a representation of the dark side in Rogue One and for a majority of The Force Awakens. And the only Force, you know, I think Lor San Tekka is essentially our introduction to the light side of the Force in The Force Awakens.
And Rogue One is doing their part, and they are being guided in direct and indirect ways. This kind of goes back to the overall, you know, kind of pseudo-religious philosophy behind the whole franchise. Just the mythical underpinnings of the whole franchise, where we don't get to see Jedis jump around and do their thing by any means, but you come close with our blind friend, and you come very close in circumstances breaking, as they do, obviously, for the heroes to carry the day, although not quite enough to survive. And so I like the non-present presence of the Force in the film.
Yeah, I thought that was great. I forgot about the crystal till we just brought it up, but I thought that was a great touch, and I thought that was a nice, you know, motif of bringing the Force into the movie, the light side of the Force into the movie.
It's coming. It's coming back, and it couldn't have done it without Rogue One, but it's not there for Rogue One yet.
Right. I mean, we have that, and then we have the mention of Obi-Wan that, you know, Jimmy Smits is going to send word to him.
Yeah.
The last thing I want to mention, I know we keep saying this, but I love the callback to Pondo Baba and Dr. Evzen.
Oh yeah, to have those guys. That was
Spaceport. I was not expecting that, and I almost jumped out of my seat when I saw it. And like Pondo Baba's like getting unchained, and like Dr. Evzen is like pulling them like back with them wherever they're going, and it was just
they
was
probably just
fun.
Got kicked out of a bar there, like the last bar there that they, you know, got kicked out of, and they couldn't drink anywhere else, and they're probably just like, fuck it, let's go to fucking Tatooine.
That's
nobody's
exactly
gonna give a
what
shit
they're
there.
Doing, right.
Yeah, fuck it. We'll go to Tatooine.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that was fun. Tons of great fan service there. I mean, that one was total fan service. Nothing to do with the plot. That's just a, hey, we see you. We see you, fans. We love you. And you know what, Star Wars? We love you, too.
Right. Well, that was fun. We seriously have to do another one because this has only been our third episode in like a year, so
I think we could probably step up the frequency a little bit. You know,
we both,
I know you've read some of the books. I read Bloodline, and so maybe at some point we'd get together and talk about some of the new canon stuff that's
coming
out.
You know what? I think we should either do it for Catalyst, if you're going to get that and read it, or Thrawn, if you're going to get that one and read that, because that one's coming out in April.
I'll grab both, but I'll get Catalyst. That's out now?
That's out now, yeah, and then that's the Mendelsohn-Mikkelsen book.
Okay, oh, that'll be a fun one.
Right, so that's, I mean, I'm already in it, and I haven't even read it yet.
Uh-huh, nice.
But, yeah, this was a lot of fun, and I'm glad that we were able to do this. So, Everybody, thanks for listening, and hopefully you didn't listen to this and not see Rogue One.
Yeah.
Which would be unfortunate on your end. But until next time, Tim and I will probably just talk about Star Wars without you.
We'll do that. But then we'll talk about Star Wars with you later, too.
Right. All right, guys. Thank you.
Thanks.